Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. Welcome to All Exits Closed. I'm Cynthia Fuller, and my guest today is my friend Steve Greenfield. And Steve is going to talk about resistance and agitation when it comes to social problems. So you go back, you know, a number of years, and you see what's going on today. Tell us a little bit about your thoughts about resistance and agitation and why it's very important.
Well, you know, resistance is an action, you know. Resistance is only a word that defines an action. It's a physical action, right? Resistance. I mean, it should seem like it should be apparent on the face of it what resistance is. And yet, people are now using the word resistance to basically say that they object to something. So, if you're resisting a war, you're not objecting to the war and having conversations with people about how you think that the war is wrong. If you're resist, that's just objecting to war. Which is kind of a personal opinion kind of thing. But if you're resisting war, it means that you are, you know, out in the street parking your car to blockade the shipping exit of a military hardware factory. It means that you are occupying the office of a congressman who voted for the war and refusing to leave until he promises to go back and change his vote. It could mean organizing a large group of people in how to implement the kind of resistance that we used to see back in the civil disobedience days, back in the labor movement, back in the civil rights movement, back in the anti-nuclear power movement in the late 1970s. And the last significant, and I might add, extremely successful resistance movement that we had in this country in the 1980s, which was ACT UP, the AIDS activists. Particularly in New York and San Francisco around this country, that through persistent obstructive action actually brought about the devotion of research dollars to AIDS research, which is why AIDS became a manageable disease in our own time instead of the death sentence that it started out being. They got all of the anti-housing discrimination and anti-healthcare discrimination laws that they were seeking passed so that people would actually not become homeless as a result of an AIDS diagnosis or lose their jobs or lose access to health care. And so, you know, the thing about resistance is that it works. You know, it's not a word. If you were in France in World War II or Poland and you joined the resistance, it didn't mean that you went to work every morning and were just really upset that the Germans were occupying your country and told everybody you knew how much you think that stinks and how you can't wait till it's over. It meant that you left home and went out in the woods with a gun to live out in the woods in encampments with other guerrilla groups waiting for the Germans to go by and shoot them. You know, like that's what joining the resistance means. Resistance is an action. And so it's kind of tragic. You know, here in our country, we've always had, and not just in our country, probably most other countries as well, we have kind of a paradox built into our psyches about the way we think about resistance, which is that most of us are very comfortable with the successes of the resistance of the past. You know, none of us want to go back to 80-hour work weeks. We're all happy that striking workers who were sometimes treated violently by the police and by the private security that were and scabs that were being hired by companies. We don't want to go back to 80-hour work weeks, right? We don't want to go back to child labor. So we're all happy that the striking workers, including the ones that got shot and killed while they were out on the picket lines, went out and did what they did. But when we have a labor situation, a problematic labor situation in our own times, nobody is interested in having a strike. You know, it's kind of like when time goes by, we're all very happy with what happened, the transformation of this country as a result of Martin Luther King's civil disobedience-oriented civil rights movement. But we do not accept when the Black Lives Matter movement of today wants to block streets, wants to interrupt political speeches, things like that. We say, no, don't do that. And it's kind of weird because the thing that they're protesting is that innocent people are getting killed and that it's institutionalized and routine and that we don't actually have a legal system that permits redress for innocent Black people being killed, even children being killed when they're in the playground. But none of us would if someone said, well, how would you feel about no longer having the Voting Rights Act, no longer having the Civil Rights Act, when the Supreme Court a few years ago removed the monitoring of Southern election processes that was written into the Voting Rights Act back in 1965, liberals got extremely outraged that Supreme Court decision was made. But nobody went out and did any of the things that Martin Luther King did that got the law passed in the first place. You know, so it's kind of strange. Like I said, we have this paradox in our head that we're all very pleased and happy about the outcome of civil disobedience movements and resistance, actual resistance over the course of American history. But nobody is willing to cross that bridge and actually take the same kind of action. And when I say action, I don't even mean a specific one-day action. Of course, all of those actions that we're talking about were concerted actions that went on day after day, year after year, until it finally became so much that even if people weren't in support of providing the relief to the demands that the resistors were demanding, they at the very least wanted the problems to go away. You know? They wanted the resistance to stop. And that's what resistance is, okay? Resistance is something that doesn't stop. It's you keep on going until you get what you want, because not everybody is going to give you what you want because they agree with you that it's right. Oftentimes, to get the majority of a particular legislature, you're also going to need the people who just want the streets opened back up again. And don't think that the legislation you're looking for is such a big deal not to provide, if that means that the streets are going to finally get opened back up again. You know, so resistance is not about persuasion. Okay, you know that I write a lot on Facebook. You know, I write persuasively. I write persuasively, and you know, and I do other things in other settings. Right, I enter political campaigns and I run for office, and I speak in front of public forums, and I try to speak persuasively. I try to convince people about the economic gain from a particular policy change, or about the moral imperative of a particular policy change, right? Which were all the same things that the labor movement, the civil rights movement, the ACT UP AIDS movement, we're all talking about, right? But none of them got to the end zone. None of them got to the finish line by persuading people. But the thing that they were persuading people to do that was effective was not to agree with them on the topic, but to join with them in the resistance activities, the street obstructions, the strikes, the office occupations, all the things, the boycotts, you know, the things that people were doing, just kept growing and growing and growing, until so many people had joined them that you know, that the farmers out in California actually had to give the grape pickers, the lettuce pickers, the wages and job protections, you know, safety protections that they were seeking, because us out in the consumer marketplace, we weren't buying any grapes and lettuce. Whether they felt it was just to give the union what they wanted had become irrelevant, because they were going out of business because none of us were eating grapes. you know, if nobody's buying your grapes, you're out of business. So, you know, you're not a grape grower anymore. So that's what resistance means. Okay, resistance means physically resisting, creating an obstruction, breaking up the framework of business as usual, showing the system that whether or not it's persuaded to agree with you, that by not doing what you're demanding, a price will be paid that you are working on developing to the point where it will be a price that they cannot afford. And that's what's
okay.
not happening in today.
Okay. So let's zero in on the student loan debt crisis. It seems as though Joe Biden is the so-called quote-unquote front runner. And he was the architect of taking bankruptcy protections away from people who had loans for higher education. Now, we're talking millions of people. And here's this guy who, you know, made millions of people their life uncomfortable, maybe unbearable, but yet nothing is said about it. So let's bring resistance and agitation up to where we are today. And what can people do who have student loans, who are drowning in it? What can they do to alleviate their problems?
Okay. Let's, you know, at the most basic level, at the entry level, before anybody is doing anything that involves risk of arrest, before, you know, anything like that, you might recall that back in 2016 that there were activists from Black Lives Matter and they started following candidates around. And they would appear at every single appearance that Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders were having to insist in public that both of those candidates make public statements, make hiring decisions about who's working in their campaign, and do things right there in that moment to address the concerns of Black Lives Matter, or that they would keep hounding them at every single event and interrupting their speeches and running out on stage and doing everything they could to make the schedule that the respective candidates were having and the talks that they were hoping to have by their own design in those settings impossible until they addressed the demands of the groups that were interrupting them. Imagine if you got 44 million people with student debt right now, right? That is a massive pool. That is a massive pool of personnel, given what's happening right now, that a campaign is already underway, the earliest in the history of elections, that this many candidates are out there. To have 44 million potential people, and of course it's not just the 44 million people that have student debt. There's other people who care about them, right? I mean, I don't have any student debt, but I would be happy to provide some level of interference and intrusion. Imagine if everywhere Joe Biden went, because with 44 million people, there are people suffering under student debt burdens everywhere he could possibly go. It's not even like people have to have the personal resources to get in a van and follow him around and stay in motels and follow him around the campaign. Out of 44 million people, there are people everywhere he could go. So imagine what his campaign would turn into in terms of how he would have to speak, what the news cameras would be recording when they show up to his events. If everywhere he went, there were 20 people who were demanding very loudly and obstructively that he answer for what he did about leaving people under the burden of student debt, even if they've become legally bankrupt and have had the courts discharge the continuing payments on all of their other kinds of debt other than student debt, and that we actually don't have a debt relief program in this country unique among all kinds of debt for student debt, and that is Joe Biden's responsibility. Imagine not just the 44 million people under debt, but how about another 20 million people that are in college right now and have no choice but to keep acquiring more and more debt as time goes by. This is a vast pool of people that would be everywhere that Joe Biden would go. Imagine if all of them agreed to temporarily and announce very publicly that they're all deciding to set aside a couple hours a week indefinitely to work for either Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, specifically over the question of student debt, and that they are going to boost those campaigns aggressively and be everywhere that Biden is going. You know, the Liz Warren thing is a particularly critical element because long before Liz Warren was hired by Barack Obama to help unravel the banking crisis back in 2009, she was, you know, a college professor at America's, you know, top-ranked law school at Harvard Law School, with her field of specialty being bankruptcy law, right? And banking regulation and then financial abuse and financial crime, and in particular, bankruptcy discharge and bankruptcy law. And she was already, you know, in the public eye to a certain degree for people who follow this kinds of things. For her congressional testimony back when Joe Biden was engineering what is now our student debt crisis on behalf of his banking backers. Everybody loves to talk about how Joe Biden sniffs people's hair, you know, but nobody is forcing the media. All it took was one woman to write an article in one magazine about how she had become uncomfortable that Joe Biden had kissed the back of her head and sniffed her hair. And I'm not downplaying that. That's pretty gross. And I've written a little bit about Joe Biden and his groping and sniffing habits. But the thing is that that seized the national consciousness, but for only about 3 days. Let's face it, it's already gone. Nobody's talking about it anymore. Now everyone's just talking about his frontrunner status, supposedly. And nobody's even talking about him, his hair sniffing anymore. But if Joe Biden, everywhere Joe Biden went where the media was gathered to cover his status as a front-running candidate, if it was impossible for those cameras to cover him and impossible for him to speak without the student loan movement, if there were a student loan movement, saying, sorry, you don't get to talk about what you came here to talk about today. The only thing that's going to be talked about today is the student loan crisis, your role in how it was created, that you will perpetuate it when you are the president, and if you've changed your thoughts about it and you don't want it perpetuated anymore, you're going to explain to us the same way Liz Warren has and the same way that Bernie Sanders has exactly what you will be doing to make it stop, and to own up to what you did and to make amends for what you did by providing a functional debt relief program specifically for student loans, and to change the way that tuition is charged at public universities at the very least, so that there will be no, you know, looming student debt crisis developing in the future, because teenagers coming out of high school will have plenty of other low-cost options of how they can pursue higher education and provide their talents to the economic development of the United States. If everywhere he went, that was the only thing, that there would be so much obstruction to the point where he would either have to respond or call the police to clear the room, and have either a response or a calling the police to clear the room every single time he made a campaign appearance, how long do you think it would be before the media would be covering something else about Joe Biden besides his frontrunner status? You know, it would happen very quickly. It would happen in less than 2 weeks' time. And so that's what,
Theoretically, that sounds wonderful. But in reality, people who have incurred debt are suffering in silence. They don't mobilize. They don't talk to anybody about it. So how could you get an immobile mass of people to really go out there and make a difference?
Well, see, that's the question, right? I mean, the first thing that you have to do is find a way to remind people that this is an option, and that it's not just a random option that nobody considered before, but something that has been used countless times, not just in the United States, but all over the world, in order for movements to actually get their demands met, people with political interests to have their demands met. You're kind of asking the specific question. You know, one of the biggest obstacles that we're facing right now is that since Donald Trump got elected, the Democrats and their allied media and their people, Democrats in social media with their hashtag resistance, there's been a massive, highly successful effort in this country to redefine the word resistance. into just meaning personal objection. And so now there's a major, you know, if this were still 3 years ago, my suggestions about how to remind people that they can step up and resist would be very different than it is now, because I don't even know what word to use. If we were to go out right now and start trying to organize people around providing actual resistance, we've already got a new hurdle in front of us, which is that nobody thinks resistance means resistance anymore. Same way that, progressive doesn't mean progressive anymore, because Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden call themselves progressives. And so how do you rally people around the idea of organizing as progressives if progressives now mean, you know, I vote for, you know, profits for health insurance companies and invading more countries? You know, so, you know, for starters, you know, I can't be sure that I can at this moment give concrete, you know, assured to be successful advice on what to do, because there's multiple stages that have to happen. The first thing we need to do is find a way to get a conversation started about what resistance means, and then go about showing people that they can step up and do it. And so it's possible that, you know, you don't look at that at a bigger picture right away. It's possible that what needs to happen right now is that existing smaller organizations, like maybe the, you know, the DSA, which has become quite prominent recently, but probably only because of electoral work and not because of the kind of agitation that left-wing movements used to be known for, you know, the ISO, the International Socialist Organization, that are still out there and work in smaller numbers, and speak to them and convince them that, you know, progressive and left-wing advocacy needs to return to its roots of obstruction and agitation, and maybe have that, maybe set up a couple of things that are small scale in specific locations to at least get it a little bit into public visibility that things are happening. And that is that is a bigger challenge than it might sound. Like, oh, yeah, that sounds simple enough. Let's get eight people in one place and have them do something. Right now, as we speak, and this has been going on for a couple of weeks already, there are Americans, several of them are people that I know personally in the Green Party, and all the people from Code Pink, like Medea Benjamin, who is a Green, by the way, in California, and who are occupying the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, D.C. The Trump administration has determined on its own that they've decided that the rebel faction in Venezuela is being treated by us as the legitimate government of Venezuela, and they are trying to remove the, you know, Maduro government appointees from the American embassy in Washington, and that and protectors have come in and they're occupying that, and the government has hired a ring of Guaido supporters to surround that embassy to make sure that the activists can't bring food in and out of the embassy, to try to starve them out through a siege. And when they try to come out, they're being beaten in the streets by the Guaido supporters just for trying to go out and get sandwiches to come back in so that everyone can eat. This is happening right now in the heart of American government, you know, in the midst of a coup that we're engineering in Venezuela, that a couple of dozen American citizens that are progressive activists are doing an act of resistance right now. They're physically occupying the Venezuelan embassy to protect it from Trump takeover. And it's not in the news. It's not getting out there. People are being beaten in the streets. It's visible, but it's not getting out there in the news. So part of that is that we have to use the new generation, the digital alternative media that we all have, our social media, to maybe stop posting articles about how Trump thinks that the reversal of the decision at the Kentucky Derby was really unfair, because I must have seen 10,000 posts about Donald Trump tweeting about the Kentucky Derby 2 days ago, but I only saw two, and from personal friends of mine, about the occupation of the Venezuelan embassy that's going on down in Washington, D.C. And so a lot of that responsibility now has to shift to us. We have to, every time that one of our friends posts about Donald Trump tweeting about the Kentucky Derby, we have to say to them, we have to, instead of, you know, clicking the laugh logo or whatever else we might do with that, we have to put on the comment line an article about what's happening at the Venezuelan embassy. We have to put on the comment line an article about the student loan crisis. We have to say and risk their ire about, hey, why are you changing the topic on my social media page? Well, I'm changing the topic because what Trump tweeted about the Kentucky Derby is not important. And for anybody who's looking at your page, I want them to know that a student loan debt relief movement is being formed, and we're going to be bird dogging Joe Biden everywhere he goes to make sure that there's media visibility to his personal responsibility for the student loan crisis and the demand that's what we need to do. We need to take over the digital alternative media and change the conversation.
Okay. I have created a Twitter account called All Exits Closed. Anybody who listens to this podcast, who is interested in resistance and agitation, please follow All Exits Closed, leave comments, and those comments will be looked at and possibly, it'll become a movement. I think that would be the way to go. What do you think, Steve?
I think it would, and I think that, part of what needs to happen is, as I said, even if it kind of annoys your friends that you're seeming to be changing the topic on their social media posts, every time somebody's posting about something that's, basically trivial gossip in the political realm, to just put the link to the Twitter page there and say, okay, now that we got your attention about the Kentucky Derby, we just wanted you to know that there's a college loan debt relief movement that's being formed, and we'd like you to come over here and consider joining it. just keep doing that and keep asking all your friends to do that also.
Okay, that is terrific. So we have to close for today. And the final thought is like Focus on Albany on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. And when you follow us on Twitter, we could begin to create a whole new movement for not only 44 million Americans, but the co-signers. There's so many people involved in this, and it just blows my mind that the politicians are not looking at this and the public is quiet about this. So I think that's the way to go. Yeah.
That should be the way to go. Yes, it is. I don't know. Do we have 30 more seconds?
Yep.
Okay. We do have 30 more seconds. Good. Just to sort of frame everything in a way that people can understand how it's easy to see what the sides are in this situation and how to know what it is that they need to do. The bailout that the government created back in 2008 and 2009 that ran several trillion dollars. The bill that Joe Biden promoted that specifically exempted college debt from being discharged through bankruptcy, all of those things. Mm-hmm. Our government consistently provides debt relief to the creditors, to the people who profit from the issuing and collection of debt. But we never provide debt relief to the borrower, to the debtor. That person becomes homeless, right? When you can't pay your mortgage, the bank takes your house. And when the banks end up unable to collect their loans and a crisis develops over that, our government always steps up to bail out them now that they're in debt because they couldn't collect on the obligations that they issued. But they will never provide that relief to people who need the relief and whose lives depend on it, whose futures depend on it, whose interest in not being homeless and out in the street, which creates another taxpayer burden all by itself, to be relieved and to see that those two things go together. Because if you know the way that collecting a debt operates, if you give the money to the person who owes the money and you require that they then pass that money along to the person they owe, then both people have been bailed out. The same money gets to the bank. This system we have in our government of treating uncollectible debt as something we redress only to the creditor but not to the borrower is a specific program designed to suppress personal income, to suppress personal growth, to leave everything about our lives under the complete control of the giant corporations. Our government's primary function is to facilitate the operation of the giant corporations that actually dominate every aspect of our lives. That's what they do. They don't make college free. They don't raise the minimum wage. They don't handle a debt collection crisis by giving the money to the people who actually owe the money. They just give it, you know, to the people who were trying to collect it and leave you homeless. Like, that is the ongoing operation of the United States government. And you have to, you actually have to become indignant about that. Okay. You have to see that for what it is and allow it to make you indignant, because then you will have the motivation you need to go out and take these actions that we're calling resistance. Because if you just think that it's wrong, but you're not actually feeling the emotion of indignation about it, then you're just going to be an objector and you're not going to become a resistor. And so always keeping people focused on the fact that these things happen by design and not by accident is the thing that people need to remember to motivate them so that they know who it is that they're resisting and why. You know, this crisis didn't just materialize. Okay, it was manufactured. It was manufactured by Joe Biden more than any other single person. And you have to feel that, feel what that feels like, so that you know that you have to go out there and hold him responsible for it.
You know, it's truly amazing that, you know, the media has made him, you know, has given him front runner status. But what Steve has been saying, you know, for the past half hour is, you know, very, very important. And social media, I mean, Twitter reaches everybody everywhere. So if you have student loan debt, you have ideas about it, you want to help us organize so that this can stop and people can live their life again. Follow All Exits Closed. Let's start a conversation. Let's do agitation. Let's do resistance. And let's get this problem solved. Steve, any final thoughts?
Just say absolutely. Couldn't agree more with everything you just said. Let's start making this happen.
Okay, great. So I look forward to you joining All Exits Closed on Twitter. And we'll get something going here. Thanks, Steve, for taking the time to be on All Exits Closed. I'm Cynthia Pooler. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and let's get something done. Thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you.